Session number 3901, reel number 9.
Alan Lawson, reel number 9.
What happened after your return to Britain in late spring 1945?
I was then detailed to go with the liberating troops to Norway. This was an airlift of, I believe, 1,000 troops from Great Dunmo. I can't remember the complete party, but the there was Roy Bolting, was officer in charge. I think Mallandyne was the still photographer. Dick Leatherborough, who was a sergeant, was a cine cameraman, along with myself. We took off. I was in a, I think it was a Stirling, with a major from PR, I think he was airborne Div. We took off, and the rest of the unit was kind of scattered around the other aircraft. And it was one of those dreadful nights. And I landed at Gardermoen Airport, along with 99 other troops. And that was the end of the airlift. The rest of the aircraft were scattered around Europe, either in mountainsides or in the North Sea, or in Holland or in France. General Urquhart was the officer commanding. He at least was there. 35 of the troops were left to guard the airport, which was full of Germans and fighter planes and bombers, and the other 65 were peppered through a train which took us down to Oslo. And on the journey down, I think General Urquhart's number 2 came to me and informed me that I would be in charge of the baggage party when we arrived at Oslo. I explained to him what my duties were. My duties were to film the parade through Oslo. And he said, your instructions are you will be in charge of the baggage party. And I think I was given 3 other...
Did you protest?
Oh, I protested, but...
Did you show him your pass?
We didn't have passes like that. I mean, he knew who I was because I got my equipment with him, with me. So, I mean, there was no, you know, there was no, no quibbling on that side. But I mean, as he said, you know, this is the position. There are 65 troops. Somebody has to be in charge of the baggage party, and you're going to be in charge of the baggage party. So, I mean, that was an order which countermanded anything I had because that was from an order from the general on the spot. So when we got to Oslo, I think I managed, I'm hazy on this, but I believe I managed to film the start of the parade. I then had to go back into the station where the 3 other lads were supervising the unloading of all the baggage. We needn't have bothered, in fact, because the Norwegian resistance had virtually taken over, and all the baggage was put into a lorry, and we were driven through Oslo with the baggage and these lads from the resistance, who were just throwing us up in the air, you know, in full of the joie de vivre. And certainly also with a little bit of aquavit thrown in as well. And that is why there's no film, really, of the liberation of Norway. And about 2 days later, my friend Roy Bolting arrived, together with Malandine and Dick Leatherborough, and he decided that we should commandeer Agfa. We didn't, ultimately. We never got into Agfa, but that's another story. And then I think I was in Oslo for 2-3 weeks, then came back to Pinewood. By this time, they were beginning to post the members of the unit back to their units. By this time, in fact, of course, all Army film personnel were in Ordnance Corps, although we still wore a multitude of badges. But for some reason, they sorted me out, and I was sent back to Burma to be an officer, a section officer.
Were you keen to go?
Not really, because a section officer's job is an administrative job, and I'd never been an administrative officer in any kind at all. I was I considered myself to be a technician, pure and simple. By the luck of the draw, I'd been given a commission, but I was a film cameraman before I was an officer. I had no administrative training at all in the Army, never had, because I'd been a technician right the way through. However, I was posted.
Why do you think they chose you in that case?
Probably a bloody nuisance, I suppose. I don't know. Anyway, I was posted along with I'm not sure. I think there were 12 others, other ranks who were going out, who on arrival at Kandy would become sergeants. We went out, our troops, we got to Karachi and the usual balls up. But Karachi, I was told that I was Indian Army troops, and I had a large argument about that, and I said I wasn't Indian Army troops, I was Saxe troops, and I had a movement order to prove it. This was waved aside, and I was sent to AK-5 in Bombay, where I was met by the officer in charge. I think it was one of the officers, I'm not sure. Who immediately admitted that I was nothing to do with AK-5 and I was really Saxe troops. And when we were in Bombay, actually, VJ happened, of course.
Before you had actually done any filming?
Before we'd done any filming at all. VJ happened when we were in Bombay. I signalled Kandy and asked for, I asked for an air priority to get me to Kandy. Derek Knight, who was in charge of the SEAC film unit, wired me back top priority air. So I went to see the air transport command man, and he said, I have a room full of those. If you want to get there quickly, I go by train. So we went by train, which was fine for me, of course, but it was pretty deadly for the other ranks, and we got to Kandy.
The whole unit went to Kandy. Didn't
yes, it? I took them all to Kandy with me, and when we got to Kandy, I was then told by Knight I was being sent to Rangoon, and I warned him that I said, look, please, you must realise I don't know anything about Army administration. So don't expect any administration from me. And he said, no, that would be all right. And off I went to take over from, I think it was a man called Hogg, And I arrived in Rangoon only to discover that Hogg had left a week prior to my arrival, and the unit was, you know, there was nobody really in charge of the unit other than the sergeant.
Who was that?
Well, I think Alec Taylor had taken on that that task because he never seemed to do any filming. He only seemed to kind of look after the mess. He seemed to be kind of the mess sergeant. And again, this is, you know, typical army film in it. Mess. Officially, it was a sergeant's mess. I lived there.
Your rank at this time was?
Captain. I lived with them. We had Colonel Frank Owen. He'd come and live with us. We had brigadiers come and live with us. They knew they were living in a sergeant's mess, although none of the sergeants, in fact, wore stripes. They hadn't for many, many months wore stripes. They just had the AFPU flash. This was a very satisfactory situation because the, if you like, the officers who'd really done the hard fighting in Burma knew these sergeants, knew that they were sergeants, but ignored the fact because, you know, they knew what they were doing, and they were grateful that, if you like, at long last, the 14th Army was getting some publicity. And as a result, these sergeants were living in officers' messes, you know, throughout the whole of Burma, and nobody ever queried it. And the new officers who were coming in didn't even know they were sergeants and never queried it either. So it was a very happy arrangement. The situation, actually, of course, by then was there was very little really to be filmed. We were.
Did anyone give you instructions on what to film?
We did the odd bit of filming if there was something really happening. I think we filmed. There were one or two things which were a very good demonstration of army life, although frowned upon by the authorities. Particularly one was. By this time, you know, there was the army had finished fighting. There was nothing really to do. The British troops were waiting to be repatriated or demobbed. They were very bored. There was just so much discipline and no more. There was an officer called Marshall, Percy Marshall. I think he was a captain, I'm not sure. He was an architect, actually, by profession. He was in the engineers. He had a colleague who I think was a lieutenant colonel. I can't remember his name, who was also an architect. Marshall was a Quaker, and he felt that there was an ideal situation. There were British troops, skilled British troops, particularly in the REs, who could pass on knowledge to the Indian troops. And he formed an organization called the Services, Arts and Technical Organization. And I'm not sure whose blessing, but he took over the Rangoon University building, which was semi-derelicted, been blitzed, and it was in a bit of a mess. And there were British troops, you know, various ranks, giving courses on bricklaying, drilling for wells, how you lay out a village, and various skills, carpentry. If any British troops wanted to go, you know, they could go. But basically, it was for use of the Indian troops. whether it was the Army Educational Corps were jealous, whether it was the old kind of British Raj attitude or not, but
you were filming this.
I filmed some of this. Yes.
Did you yourself as a captain still use a camera?
Oh yes. Oh Lord, yes. Oh yes. Yes, yes.
There was never a situation where only sergeants filmed.
No, not as far as I was concerned. We filmed this, but whether it was used or not, I don't know. I doubt it very much. But anyway, GOC Burma Command closed it down.
Were you interested in the politics of Burma at that time?
Oh yes, very much so. But it was a very strange situation actually.
Did it affect the way you filmed events?
No.
Do you think that politics ever affected the way people filmed events in the Army Film Unit? In your experience?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. Can't see how one really could in those in that situation. No, my interest in politics didn't if you like go with filming at all. It was purely an interest in politics.
You never thought you could make a point.
No, because unless one has control of the distribution of it, it would never see the light of day anyway. I wasn't foolish enough to do that. I mean, that was not on. I don't think that kind of thing. Burma at that particular time was an interesting place to be. Because it was just after the 45 general election. There was a great thing about bringing the troops home. Rangoon was full of troops waiting repatriation and demob. And it wasn't happening. It was a very good reason for it not happening, but the thing was that nobody bothered to tell the troops. I mean, the reason for it not happening was, in fact, it was the repatriation of the prisoners of war. I mean, we saw quite a...
Did you film that?
Well, no, because by the time they'd arrived in Rangoon, they had been partly rehabilitated.
Did you have anything to do with the filming of the execution of the Japanese war criminals?
No, not at all. I was at one of the surrender ceremonies in Rangoon, which was quite impressive. And this is, in fact, My opinion of Lord Louis went very much higher than it had been, because he arrived. I don't know if it was on that particular occasion, and did a review of the Indian troops, under his command in that area, and spoke to them a proper speech in Urdu. I mean, it was a proper speech. It wasn't, thank you very much, chaps, goodbye. It was a proper speech, this had an amazing effect upon the Indian troops. I mean, it was an unheard of thing for a British officer to do a thing like that at a great big parade. I mean, Bill Slim, he was a wonderful man. I mean, he spoke to his Gurkhas, he spoke Gurkhali. I mean, he was fluent speaker in Gurkhali, and that was one of his great joys, was always to mix with his Gurkhas. But this was on a very formal occasion, it was very impressive, very impressive. Anyway, going back, the situation in Rangoon had got to a very, very... it was quite explosive, I suppose, in a way. They'd stopped... there was a big transit camp in Rangoon itself. There was another transit camp out at Meng Ludon, I think it is. That's the airport for Rangoon, which was about 15, 20 miles from Rangoon. And there used to be daily transport in, and the troops who were in the Meng Ludon transit camp used to come into Rangoon. Well, they decided to stop that transport. So there were these men completely isolated out in this dump, really. So the first thing that happened there was they set fire to the Effie. In Rangoon itself, the transit camp, I think GOC Burma Command went to address the troops there, and instead of explaining to them about the repatriation of the prisoners of war, he didn't explain that at all. He waffled on, and as a result, the troops at the meeting just walked out on him and left him standing on the platform. They'd refused to shave, they'd refused to do duties. Then the next thing I remember happening was an order was issued that on no account were British troops to fraternise with Burmese families without written permission from their CO or officer in charge, and it had to be for every single occasion. Well, I mean, the whole of my little unit, they all had their own Burmese friends, their Burmese family friends, and...
Did you make sure that order was observed?
Certainly not, because, I mean, I had Burmese family friends. I also had Burmese friends. If you like, they were political friends. I wasn't going to ask anybody's permission if I could go and see them. I mean, it was a ridiculous situation. There was also an Anglo-Burmese society where Burmese families, you know, and English troops mixed. I think there was a small amount of refreshment, but mostly for discussion.
What were the technical problems of filming in a tropical climate?
Under war conditions, and especially in the last war, heat is a big enemy, of course, because your stock deteriorates rapidly if it gets hot. Humidity, that and condensation, that also makes your film stick. So, in other words, it won't run through the camera properly. Humidity and condensation, you get your lenses start growing fungus. These are the that also, of course, particularly in Burma, was dust, which in certain type of cameras you can get a build up in the camera gate and start getting scratches. Of course, things have altered a lot now, what with the introduction of silica gel and refrigerating cans and things like this. So those problems are much reduced. I suppose those really are the basic problems. And also, in Burma, because things were on the move so quickly, if you did have a major camera fault, there was nothing really you could do about it other than send your equipment back and sit at the airport and wait for something else, or sit at the airstrip and wait for a replacement camera.
Send it back where?
Well, it would have gone back, I imagine, to Kandy, really. This is... I don't think there was any repairs being done in the field at all in Burma. It would have gone back to Kandy.
How was the unit organised?
Well, in Burma, when I got there as a section officer, There was a lot of moving around of personnel, of sergeants. For what reason, I don't know.
Did they know?
No, not really. I think it was, you know, it was nice to move people around, feel that you could move people around. I know that I was summoned to meet Derek Knight at Pegu, which was a jolly good 60 miles away from Rangoon. I went up, met him there, wondered what he wanted, and it was really to pass the time of day away. I wasn't particularly pleased, obviously.
Did you tell him?
Well, I did indicate I thought it was a bit of a waste of time. And I drove back to Rangoon, of course, through a thunderstorm, so I wasn't particularly pleased at being summoned that distance. Then, a little later on, I was summoned to Singapore for a conference, and for the life of me, I can't imagine what I even went for. It so happened that I nearly lost my life, because we went down in the drink in the Gulf of Phuket. So I had every reason to be a little bit jaundiced about my opinion of Derek Knight, and even more so was when I went to Singapore for repatriation. You know, prior to DMOB, I found there was a cable waiting for me, which had been sent to me by Grieve Del Struther, asking me if I would be interested in a job in the BBC, and the cable had been there a month waiting. It hadn't been forwarded. And I had the great joy of getting him to send a top priority cable in answer. So, you know, I have rather jaundiced view of Derek Knight. And I think that opinion was shared with the rest of the staff, or rest of the cameramen. He wasn't, certainly wasn't popular.